Hello and welcome back to Wrong Opinions Only with your hosts Justin and Kayla. And we are hyped today, folks. We are going to talk about one of our favorite movies, I think ever, and the sequel, which we will be seeing exactly 1 week from the day we are recording this podcast. I am hyped, Kayla. What are we talking about?
We are talking about Dune. And that's right. Dune 2, part 2, I should say, is coming out in theaters soon. We're going to get to see it a week early, and we are just buzzing at the idea. And I thought it might be fun to talk about Dune 1, part 1, how we saw it, what we loved about it, what maybe we disliked about it, and just overall why I think we can easily say it's a 5 VHS tape film for us, similar to the 5 VHS tapes we gave last week. So I can't wait to get into it. All right. First off, Dune is a sci-fi film. I'm curious, Justin, because, you know, we've reviewed a couple sci-fi different films, but I think Dune is almost across several genres, but definitely sci-fi comes up. Are you a fan of sci-fi films? Are you a fan of, like, this type of film? Is there any comparable sci-fi film to this?
So I am a little picky on sci-fi. Like, I don't like the really crazy sci-fi stuff, but Dune is right up my alley, where it's this massive world-building experience where you have these great houses, there's enemies that kind of have this political back and forth for centuries, and trying to capture that well on film, I think, is very difficult. So when it is done, like in Dune, I think Star Wars has a type to this, but that's a little bit more science fiction-y than Dune, in my opinion. And then the TV show Foundation on Apple TV, which they've recently started adapting that book to a series, has very similar vibes to Dune, and I'm really into that as well. It's just that whole genre is it's a little tighter than I think most sci-fi fans for me.
Yeah, I hate to phrase it this way, but it's almost like I prefer digestible sci-fi. You know, when I'm watching a movie like Arrival, which we may touch on later, I enjoy that it has some relation to the real world and then just has some sort of sci-fi elaborate technology or alien or whichever. But like most of the world is understandable. And on the other side, I enjoy like when it's a completely different world, like Dune or Star Wars. It's just when things start to get like so heavy in like a Star Trek, like I got to know all these different things, it really starts to lose me. Like, honestly, Star Wars is kind of exception to me with space, and everyone should know my issues with time travel. So when they start bringing in sci-fi like time travel, my brain is checked out, as you know.
Oh yeah, completely agree. That's a good way to put it. Digestible sci-fi, where you can understand what's happening in this world because it's people from different planets that are basically like large cities, and they have the ability to travel between planets. There's nothing really crazy that takes you out of that. We have unique creatures that are very well depicted in it. So the sandworms as part of Dune, where it's not like they're out there talking and walking around in the streets, but they are a threat. So they'd be like, hey, if you're in the middle of the ocean and there's a shark coming at you, you got to be scared. And it's like, that is like a comparable feature to if you're in this desert, we also have creatures that live underneath the sand. So it's got enough crossover to, in my opinion, like more of a realism aspect to the sci-fi, is instead of just totally out there robots and aliens galore, you know?
Oh yeah, I completely agree. It's just the way that you see something. And sometimes it's just if you saw it and you got into it, and you know, now we have the internet, so it's a lot easier to like search up terms or different things. I remember even watching a fantasy show, Game of Thrones, and the first couple episodes I had to search because I was so confused when they threw like 50 names out and I wasn't sure who was who in this type of dynamic. And so when you do get sci-fi films kind of like that, where you're like, what? Did I miss something? Or, you know, this is set in so many foundational things to today in the real world, such as like religion and politics. And honestly, like, you know, they need sand to travel across, you know, like gas. You think about the different kind of comparable dynamics here with like gas and different things, like oil. And so it's like, you know, you can see where in another world similar, we have similar themes here on Earth in a crazy sci-fi movie like this.
And spice is what you're talking about is in Dune, right? Which
yes.
They basically said, oh, we found spice, which gives you kind of this high, essentially, right? It gets you kind of a little loopy, but they realize that if they mine it, they can use it for space travel. So, or not space travel, but interplanetary travel. So it's like a very valuable resource, which is why the people who basically were on Arrakis for so long have built up such a great wealth, because they've been able to mine and sell spice. And that gives me kind of a little bit of a tie-in to his Dark Materials, which I've talked about before. It's a little bit different, but instead of spice, they have dust in that. And it's got a similar premise of you can't really see it, but it's used for like these interdimensional travel. So it's like these things that you can see in a day-to-day in the real world, but they have different effects in the sci-fi story that we're watching, so you can relate to it instead of just being like, that's something I can't even fathom, you know?
Absolutely. And it kind of makes me wonder, you know, we're talking about, of course, the 2021 Dune, but there was a previous Dune film. Have you seen that film, Justin? Just out of curiosity.
I have not. And I specifically have not because I've not read the books, which I also want to do, even though I'm not a big sci-fi book reader. I don't want to spoil what happens in Dune 2. And from what I am hearing, there will be a Dune 3. So I don't want to ruin the story by watching the original where it was all condensed into one film. And I've heard kind of like, oh, it was pretty good, but there was just too much to cover in one movie. So I'm really glad that the way they broke it out for this reinvention is to separate it out into 2 and 3 films.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So we kind of, you know, we're teens, early adults in the era of let's stretch a 3-book Twilight into 4 films, let's stretch Hunger Games into 4 films, and then a 5th, you know, like it's all there of how can we kind of share a complicated story. And I think that's kind of, you know, I think the original Dune was, you know, a limit of its time for sure. I mean, you're thinking about the planetary, you know, things you need to show and articulate, you know, in the 70s. And so that's obviously going to be a marker of time when you're rewatching it. And so I think it's a cult favorite. I think some people just love it just at the time, you know, wanting that like big picture sci-fi. And I think some people are like, especially the book lovers, were disappointed in how the movie kind of came out from how they understood the book and read it and enjoyed it. So it was limited. So I am curious to return to it. I agree with you. I think I'd prefer to watch kind of this current iteration of Dune and then go back. I do want to read the book as well. So that may be fun for the summer, is to read the book and see what kind of insight we get for sure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the books that I can see myself actually diving into that is a fiction-based novel. So we'll see. I think it's a series of 3 books are the main ones, right? So they're basically adapting those into different films now. So last I heard, Denis Villeneuve said that he is planning and they basically finished the script and want to start production on a part 3, but that has not been confirmed by Warner Brothers yet. So it hasn't been picked up. I assume with how well the first one did and the hype for the second movie, they will pick it up. I know these cost a lot to make, but they also make a ton in the box office. So hopefully we don't just get stuck, because I saw something where when they signed up for the first movie, they did not have a 2-film deal in place, but he knew he wanted to stretch this out to multiple films. So when they finished shooting, theoretically, that could have just been the only Dune film, and then we're just left on that big old cliffhanger of what the hell is happening here with Paul Atreides. So I think they'll pick it back up, and I'm excited that they're going to stretch this out into 3 films.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard anything kind of cemented in 3, so that's interesting. You know, they really love to have you go see a film and then kind of see that end title of to be continued in another film. But I would rather a movie take, you know, another film to kind of finish the story than to feel like, you know, something so complex is rushed in a 2-hour film, because this is such a like huge story and we really have been out of it. I don't look up stuff. I'm very curious about, you know, Paul, the character of Paul and what happens, but I really love like the organic feeling of watching a story unfold and you don't know what's going to happen, especially with a text that's, you know, several years old at this point. So, you know, that's fun. Fun as a watcher.
Yeah, I think the original original novel came out in the 60s, if I'm not mistaken. So I think the mid-60s. So we're 60 years later putting this film together, and it still has that that place in the modern world, essentially, where you have these parallels, like you mentioned, between the politics and the religion and kind of these people rising to power, or so we're led to believe with how the last movie ended. So it's one of my favorite franchises going, and there's only one movie out, but I am just that invested in it. It's just one of those, as soon as I finish watching it, I can pretty much put it right back on and just dive right back into it.
Absolutely. And let's talk a little bit about Denis Villeneuve, because he's done a lot of the films that we enjoy watching. Obviously, we both have talked about Arrival a lot on this platform. But I mean, have you seen Sicario? I feel like that was on your list recently. Did you see it?
I did. I watched Sicario a couple months ago and really enjoyed it. I thought that it was really well done. Josh Brolin and Emily Blunt in that one, and they were phenomenal. He has a like an intention behind his filmmaking where it's not like Fincher per se, but he is very much in, I'm going to absorb you in this world with the visuals. And he thinks about the little things. Like, I mean, in the first Dune, we have all these creative new equipment, machines, these the Dragonfly helicopters, which were super freaking cool, that he worked with Hans Zimmer on to come up with a unique sound for those. You know, Sicario is your typical, you know, you could see it as like a typical, all right, there's this cartel story and you're trying to get in and out. But he kind of takes it in a different direction, and it keeps you on your toes a little bit, where you don't know who you're rooting for at certain points, which just sets it apart from those other films. And you know my opinion on Arrival. I love Arrival. I love what he did with that, where he has the Easter eggs, the hints throughout, and then it kind of brings it home at the end of, okay, this story is it's not a linear story, and not everybody's taking it the same way as Amy Adams' character is, because she knows what's coming. And then Prisoners is another movie that I have not revisited lately. I don't know if you've seen that, Kayla, but that was, I thought it was really well done, but it is a very heavy movie. And it's talking, you know, these parents lose their kids and they're trying to find what happened to them. And like, it's very dark, very heavy. But again, it's not your stereotypical parents are going after the bad guys, working with the cops, and they get it done. It's like a lot of twists and turns, and it's like you're so uncomfortable watching it, but you feel so many different emotions throughout the film that it's just, it's very memorable, to say the least.
Yes. And I think another thing Denis does that is like perfect for this plot or this story, and probably he's interested in these types of stories, and that's why he often, you know, directs them, which is like similarly to Sicario and Arrival, you have a messy kind of good and evil, and it's not always so clear. You know, Sicario, you have this police force that is doing crimes, doing things that if they were in the U.S. would absolutely be, you know, they would be in trouble. They'd go to jail, whatever would happen to them. But their intention is like, well, you kind of have to do this dirty work to do good ultimately. Now, does that make it good in nature just because that's a fact? No. And Emily Blunt's character kind of struggles with the line of where she's being brought into, and it gets crazy dark, and it's often questioning who's on the right side here. Like, are they, you know, they're looking at her like, you haven't been in the shit, so you don't know. And she's like, it doesn't matter. There's good and there's bad, and you guys are doing bad. It doesn't matter what the outcome of it ends up being. And so similarly, I'd say in Arrival, where you see these aliens and you're like, are they bad? Are they evil? Are they going to like kill everyone? Who's good? Who's bad? And without knowing kind of what's ahead for Paul, the character in Dune, similarly, he's, you know, looked at as this like possible great figure, and it becomes like, does he believe it more, and does that drive him to maybe bad things? That kind of conflict.
Oh, I have some predictions when we start doing our part two preview here. I got some predictions for good old Paul Atreides.
I hope there's some real Dune lovers who've read the book and maybe seen like other versions that maybe don't obviously spoil it for us, but I'm curious how our predictions kind of go in terms of the actual story that's being said. But he just excels at that. And I think this is a similar story in Dune without knowing what's going to happen, is who's right, who's wrong. And you know, I love my Anakin Skywalker, so I'm just sensing some similar ideas here. So, you know, I love it.
Oh, that's the exact comparison I was going to make later, Kayla. In my notes, I said, I'm getting an Anakin vibe here.
This is what happens when we're best friends, you know? we do start to, we do agree on some things, you guys. Okay, so let's go into Dune 1, but I want to ask about your first time watching this film. It came out in 2021. So what was your experience watching it for the first time?
Immediately loved it. Saw it on the big screen, was obsessed with it. It came out on HBO Max after, watched it again, went back to see it in theaters again, watched it on HBO Max a few more times, went back to see it in theaters with you again about a week or so ago. And just seeing this film specifically on the big screen brings it to another level entirely. Like watching it at home, very good, but being immersed with the massive screen, the sound, the silence, you're focused, you're not pulling out your phone, you're not going to grab a drink. You are like I said, fully immersed in this world that he is building. I just love it, Kayla. I can't get enough of it. I would probably go see it again today.
100%. So let's go. I watched it at home on HBO Max. It was like late too. It was like late and I was like, oh, Dune's out. I really want to watch it. And, you know, I remember really enjoying it. Like, I really was like, wow, this is a really good film. But for some reason, I hadn't revisited it again. Like, I just knew it to be a really good film. And we saw it recently. We saw it last week in theaters. That was my first time watching it in theaters. And honestly, the second time I've seen the movie. And I think the closer I got to part two, I was like, oh, I want to watch it close too. And I'm actually glad I did, because a lot of scenes were almost new to me because it had been, you know, 2 years since I had seen it. And so even though I knew basic plot where it was going, I was surprised by different like dialogue and things that happen. And honestly, the theater experience, like you said, was top tier. If you get a chance to see the re-release of Dune in theaters, I highly, highly recommend. A lot of times it's comparable. Sometimes if you have a good TV, good soundbar at home, but I'm telling you, it is a completely different experience in theaters, and I'm so grateful that we did do that last week for sure.
Yeah, and he loves to throw up those big wide shots of like the sand dunes or the worlds, and it takes it to another level when you're seeing that in theaters as opposed to at home. But you know, also if you haven't watched it at home if that's the only way you can, because we can't recommend this.
Yes, and it's on Netflix right now. So if you have a Netflix subscription, go check it out. Absolutely. All right, let's go ahead and jump into our Dune 1 discussion. So a little synopsis. This film came out again in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve, and it is the first of a two-part adaptation of the 1965 novel of the same name from Frank Herbert's Dune franchise. So there's several books in this series. It's set in the far distant future, and a film follows Paul Atreides as his family, the noble House Atreides, is thrust into a war for the deadly and inhospitable desert planet Arrakis. This is, again, another great part of this film is it's completely star-studded. Timothy Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson. I love her. She's really having, I feel like, the last great 2 years, and fantastic. She's so amazing. Good.
This and Silo, similar vibes to
it. And I don't know if you've seen her Dune 2 promotion, but she's really having, like, people are just trending her all over the place for the stuff she says. It's so good. You have Oscar Isaac. We'd love to see him. Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, Dave Bautista, Stephen McKinney, Henderson, Zendaya, much dreams for her, Chang Chen, Sharon Duncan-Brewster, Charlotte Rampling, and Jason Momoa, and Javier Bardem, who's kind of in the later half of the movie. Completely star-studded, and they're like fantastically casted, I gotta say.
Yeah, absolutely great cast. I know in the books, Paul is supposed to be, I think, like 15 or 16 years old. So Timothy Chalamet is a little bit older than that. But I think he is a perfect role, perfectly cast for this type of role, where it's somebody who he still looks very young, which we talked about last week a little bit. So he can play these younger roles and he can kind of grow into this spot. But I just can't believe the star-studded cast of Dune 1 and Dune 2 is going to even bring in some more big heavy
hitters. What I love about Timothy is that Timmy, as his co-stars often call, which always makes me laugh because he's so a Timmy, is that he plays such characters with depth and intensity. I mean, he's played like addicted sons. He's played like, you know, of the times, Little Women, like a Lady Bird, like the poet, cool guy that's actually an asshole. Like he has such, you know, variety of roles that he enjoys being in and he excels in. But like when you see him talk, it is like he's such a young adult in his generation. Like he's
like a young bro.
And when he talks sometimes, yeah. I'm like, this is not connecting for me. I don't understand how, like, you are the same age as all these people, but you are such a bro. You are such a, like, it's so funny to me. And I think that's what's amazing about acting and him, because he's completely believable as Paul, but when he's just rapping on some, like, talk show and talking about, like, Snapchat, I'm just like, yeah, this makes sense. Okay, all right.
That's how good of an actor he is. Like, how many really top-notch actors around his age range do we have right now? He's got to be very close to the top of the list, and he does take these interesting roles. We talked about Wonka earlier. That's something a little outside of the comfort zone, but he did it, and like the movies you mentioned, he will take small parts in bigger movies just to kind of test himself out a little bit, which is not something you see a lot, at least recently, with young actors, because you get thrust into these franchises or these Marvel superhero movies and you get kind of stuck there. But he's kind of pulling more of like more of a Leo vibe almost, where he's trying these different roles out, he's showing his range, and then as he gets older, he's going to probably expand that into different types of roles, because he right now can play a 15-year-old or a 25-year-old. Like, he's got that face to him where he can play pretty much anybody in that range, which affords him a lot of opportunities for these types of movies, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if it's great on his management side or he's kind of selecting these roles, but like, I mean, the film Call Me By Your Name is so heartbreakingly good. Arnie Hammer stuff aside, it's just a phenomenal film. And, you know, it's interesting him in these roles. I almost hope he kind of goes a little Matt Damon in his trajectory, because I think he does have such a silly, goofy side. And what I love about Matt Damon is that he is game for like quick cameos. He's game for like the intense, I'm the main lead of this film drama. And he's there for, you know, more of the like funnier version of comedies. You know, like I hope he goes more that way, because we get to one, see him more, and we get to see that ability to be in these different roles than say Leo, who's definitely on the very serious track these days. You know, we don't see that often.
That's true. He is right now kind of in between the two of them, because I love Matt Damon. He's one of my favorite actors, and he is great because he doesn't take things too seriously most of the time. You can even tell by the Super Bowl commercial, right? He's in the Dunkin', what they call him, the Dunk Kings, like little rap group or whatever, and he's off to the side making fun of himself and Ben Affleck, essentially. So those are great to see him in, but he did not really ascend to that top movie star status like a Leo did, or a Denzel did, or a Tom Cruise did. You know, he was content being kind of middle of the road, the top of the middle sector of actors, essentially, right? Where he can do all these creative things. But I think based on what we've seen so far from Chalamet, he probably wants to be one of those in Oscar contention every time he does a movie at some point.
But I think absolutely he'll get there. I mean, he's very young. I also love the class, I guess I'd say, because I almost think of it as like actor classes, like who you came up with. And so, you know, he's surrounded by similarly talented, like Zendaya, obviously in this film. They're really close fashion icons as they put themselves forward. Florence Pugh, like there's just all these kind of young mid-20s like actors that are coming out and just fucking killing it. I have no way. I mean, like TV, movies, like their interactions, they're charismatic. I mean, when you're seeing clips of these actors on the screen, you're enjoying it, whether it's a clip of a movie or it's a clip on them on a talk show. Like they're just completely, you're like, I could come up to these people and say hi, you know, like it's just, it's a great energy among this class of actors, I think.
Couldn't agree more, Kayla.
All right, so let's just talk about the film. I mean, certainly we're going to spotlight other actors when we talk about some of our scenes. But, like, overall, where do you want to start in the movie? Do you want to start beginning to end? Do you just want to pop out about your favorite scenes? What of Dune do you want to discuss?
Well, I'll just go with overall major thoughts here, and then we can kind of get into scenes after that. But we talked about this on the 5EHS episode last week. I am a sucker for these tropes about the apprehensive hero, doesn't want to be the leader, but is thrust into that type of role. There's some type of prophecy that's swirling around that may involve him, but he, as Jon Snow says, I don't want it. So he doesn't want it, but he kind of wants it, right? So I like seeing just the transformation of actors in those types of roles where he comes up as this apprehensive person in this great house and everything is taken from him. And now he realizes, okay, I need to step up. I need to, you see, for the first time, really, when he basically offers to be the champion for his mother in this fight with the Fremen, where he goes, I need to do this. This is my time to step up for my family, for my people. And just seeing how that's going to expand throughout the rest of Dune 1 and then Dune 2 and potentially Dune 3 is really one of those through lines that I'm always in for.
Absolutely. And I love like how the beginning of the film starts, which is we don't know the history of Spice or this world or this family, this house. And so I really appreciate that they use different ways to relay that information without feeling like it's an overture of text and you're trying to incorporate the whole political landscape of this world. It was some quick, simple visualizations of him, almost like how they learn history, which are like, is this voice kind of coming from this device? And you just kind of like a Siri version in the future. And so he's just like, you're learning about some of the political stuff just from this voice narrating different things about sandworms. And it doesn't get too detailed. You get to experience it and see what it is from the first time. But like right away, you're kind of like, okay, I'm kind of following this. And, you know, there's the part of him where he's balancing his father, Duke Oscar Isaac, and that responsibility of politics and them being, you know, at the beginning, it starts where he's being sent to this planet Arrakis to kind of take control of it and manage the spice after a previous house couldn't accomplish it and were kind of cast out and left.
House Harkonnen, who was like the house wealthiest house, yes, in the universe because they've been mining spice for so long.
Yes. And they all look like Voldemort because they're all in the darkness. So they're all, yep, like pale, bald, and sickly and scary, honestly. And so then you have also his mother. And what I love about, obviously, Rebecca Ferguson, other than her being Rebecca Ferguson, is like she has this power, this ability, and this whole other side apart from her husband. Actually, not husband. It's important to know that they're not married, that she's like the kind of concubine of the house is kind of how she's treated. They never get married. And so she has her own rich history, and it's this, you know, kind of witch-like women cult. I don't know how else to phrase that, Justin.
The Bene Gesserit you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is such a cool little, like you said, they don't just thrust exposition upon you, mm-hmm, in this movie. They have little pieces here or there, like at breakfast when she's like, do the voice, and he's shy and can't quite do it, and you can kind of see that she's trying to teach him, but you're not quite sure what.
Yes, and being introduced to the voice, which is this ability to control someone, you kind of like speak in this kind of like loud whisper, deep, kind of powerful, magical voice. And so he's practicing, and that's an ability he gets from his mother's side and part of this thing. And their culture has a prophecy of like someone who has like the power to kind of unite and all this stuff. And so she actually gets to choose what gender of a child she has. So she chooses to have a male because the prophecy is kind of that a, you know, man will come into power and have these abilities. So, I mean, all of that's super cool to follow.
But the fact that she had a son is mm-hmm. a point of discontention with the motherhood, right? The Bene Gesserit, where they're like, you're only supposed to have daughters because we don't fully trust. We tell you what to have because we don't trust basically that a male, if he gets this type of power, would be able to use it wisely because, as we all know, just women are better than men. So, you know, and I trust them.
That's
more
also
with the
what I heard.
Universe,
yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, he gets tested early on. You know, it's not just being tested in him showing up at his father's table to show up as a politician, but then also being tested on his abilities, because someone with this power, this ability that she's been training him, you know, as he's growing up, can't be trusted. They'll kill him. And so they're very harsh with like, we'll protect you if you're with us, but if you're against us, we can't have you exist. And you can imagine in a story that's going to envelope with the religion, the power to command is scary. It's scary. That's quite a power if you're seen as kind of a leader of the new world. And so, I don't know, I guess we'll go into theories later on that. But what else for you, Justin?
Yeah, and you do see how he gets tested with the putting the hand in the box, like you said, and are you able to kind of keep your composure and not just like lash out, which is setting you up for, all right, this is a good sign. He can control his emotions a little bit, but he also doesn't quite understand the power he has, because they ask him about these visions you're having, right? We hear you're having these visions, but in his mind, they're dreams. They're kind of disjointed. Like, he can't quite make out. They're not full. So he knows there's bits and pieces that mean something, but they don't happen exactly how they're shown. And you kind of see as the movie goes along that he's starting to understand those a little bit better and understanding the greater context behind them and not just taking them as gospel, which just proves that he's getting more comfortable with this type of power. And I just, I love when he gets to Arrakis, and even before he gets to Arrakis, like you said, they show him trying to research. He's studying the place he's going, their customs, the people there, how to ingratiate himself. Like, even though he said he doesn't want to be the Duke of the House, he is putting in the effort behind the scenes here to really understand what he's getting himself into, which is a choice, because it's not like he's just some spoiled kid who is getting pulled that way and like has all these gifts naturally, but he's actually putting in the effort and shows that he can really adapt depending on what he needs to be.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, by the time they realize that, you know, his father says we're going here, we're going to Arrakis, and you know, it's all understood to be basically like, we're being selected here and we're almost doomed to start, because, you know, the technology there to mine spice is so decrepit. It was just left in kind of ruins, and it's almost, and they have a quota to hit. And if you don't hit that quota, it's very much implied, you know, bad things will happen to you. And so already the family, the house, feels this pressure of like, we have to be able to right this area. And one way is to deal with the Fremen, which we haven't mentioned, which is the actual people of Arrakis
the
who
Fremen,
live
Kayla.
There.
The Fremen.
Yes, Fremen, sorry. And so, you know, previously House Arrakis had a conflict with them and was basically like imprisoning them, torturing them, killing them, whatever. They just wanted their spice, ruining their, you know, areas that they lived in. And so it was a lot of war happening, a lot of bullying, a lot of, you know, murder. And so, you know, Oscar Isaac's character wants to right that wrong by working with them, like coming to some sort of agreement. Like, I'm not going to ruin your housing, your areas, but I need to mine, we need spice. So can we come to some sort of peaceful agreement where we can kind of coexist together?
Yeah. And they really point out that Oscar Isaac's character, their Duke here, he is the head of this house, but he is a good guy, somebody who develops a trust with his people and those around him. He's not one of these, you know, malicious leaders that is going like out of his way to tear others down. You see this when he meets people for the first time. He says, no, let them through. Let me talk to them. That's okay. We don't need to like hold them at knife point. I trust them. And he's trying to kind of show his son, like, this is the proper way to lead. I need you to understand that we can work with people. We don't need to take things by force, which I think is going to be a pretty big through line throughout the entire series of films here. And then the big, you know, statement that he says, right, is, hey, you know, they're setting us up to fail here. We've already cultivated air and sea power. Now we need to cultivate desert power. We need to work with the Fremen. We can't just get sent here to fail. We need to just switch everything up, turn a 180 here, work with the people that nobody else wants to work with, because that's how we are going to make this family and this planet kind of thrive going into the future. And his character was so well played by Oscar Isaac, and I love that they had those little nuances throughout.
I mean, listen, you know, Denis, no, you know, slack when it comes to casting Oscar Isaac, which we love and appreciate, even though he didn't have a dance number in this film, wouldn't have fit. But I agree. It's such a important, you know, to get that kind of relationship with the Duke, because later on in the film, he's not long for this world. He will not, unless it's in flashbacks, it doesn't seem like he's going to be in part two, because he's killed his last breath, you know, in this attack that happens on Arrakis, which ended up being a coup the whole time. And so House Arrakis, you know, descends on Arrakis to basically wipe out.
I understand the combination of words here. But House Harkonnen descends on Arrakis.
Thank you. Thank you.
I like what you said, guys, though. Let's just go with Arrakis. That's Harkonnen and Arrakis. It's all in one.
Yeah, let's do it. You know, yeah. Let's blend. I'm creating new language as we go along. I actually wrote on Dune Part 2. And so I said it was too confusing with all these names. And so, you know, you have this just, and I will say, like, it has to tell you about Paul, about the difference between his parents and, you know, the position he's in, but these dreams and what do they mean? And the prophecy of his mother's, you know, witchy cult, and then the, you know, the Fremen, and how they kind of look at him also. And so it's interesting to see, you know, you have to get all of that in the beginning of the film, you know?
Yeah. And I love that Denis really, like we said, he has like this intention in his filmmaking where this costs a lot of money to make. I believe the total budget was like $165 million for this. It made over 400 mil worldwide, but he goes to location. Like, they filmed in Jordan and Abu Dhabi and Norway. Like, they went to these spots and they didn't use the green screen. And I love that these at least well-established directors are feeling comfortable to stick with that. Be like, no, I'm only doing this film if we can do it my way, if we can film on location in spots and get rid of all the heavy CGI that's done in so many of the other superhero movies. Obviously, you still need some of those for the special effects, the sandworms, that type of stuff. But just filming on location makes everything just so much more clear and immersive when you're watching it, which just adds so much to this type of movie.
And the pacing of this film is so well done because there is a lot of storytelling that has to happen. It takes a little bit before you land on Arrakis, before Paul kind of sees kind of what it's like. And because you're kind of seeing it through his eyes and his first time. And by the time you do get to this danger, something's happening. You know, Paul almost gets assassinated and you're feeling this threat. You're seeing these secret meetings that are happening. And, you know, when it actually descends, when this war happens, you're feeling that buzz of like anticipation of something's like they're in danger, you know? And so it's fire from the beginning that they descend in the middle of the night and watching the quietness of their house and then seeing, you know, people literally like fall almost like they're in slow motion down, like gliding
like, down. Yeah.
It's so funny to me because they're like these monstrous looking people and they just kind of like lightly descend down on the ground and then just like brutally murder anyone they come across.
Yeah. And they fit so much in. Like before the massive battle scene. The massive battle scene is what, like halfway through the movie, give or take? because they're doing so much of this setup. And then we have to, how are Paul and his mother going to survive after this? But one of my favorite scenes of the movie, I'll just say it now, it's a smaller scene, but it's when they're trying on the still suits for the first time with the doctor, Liat Kynes, the ecologist that's basically sent for the transition there. But it sounds like she was told by the Emperor they're doomed to fail, like don't help them at all. And when she's showing them these still suits, which are another really cool thing that I think they developed very well for the film, where they absorb all of your basically bodily moisture so that you don't lose it, so you can survive in these crazy conditions of Arrakis. And Paul puts on the still suit himself, and she goes, oh, is this not your first time? You've worn one before? He goes, oh, no, first time. And it's just one of those moments where she's like, oh, shit, like nobody really knows how to wear one of these unless we get back to the prophecy. Maybe he really is the prophet. Like, how else would he just know that he needs to wear it this specific way? He just said it feels right. And then she kind of mumbles something in Fremen under her breath of, is this the prophet? You know, and you see him kind of, that's, I think, one of the first moments where he starts slightly believing, hey, is this thing real? Like, am I, like, because at first he's like, all right, that's ridiculous, that's ridiculous. And that's kind of the first point where he's like, huh, maybe there is something to this prophecy everybody's telling me about.
Yeah, so, you know, it's established, too, when the Jesseret meets with Paul, and that they kind of help, you know, navigate, that they have their finger kind of on the needle. And so they use their kind of abilities to help Paul. She's like, I'll help him a little. We'll kind of lay out that maybe he could be the one, you know, that the Fremen think will, you know, lead them into some great Nirvana-like life. I don't know. And so it's interesting to see, you know, like that scene you just described where he automatically knows how to wear the suit in, you know, the way that the Fremen do, who have lived there all their lives. And so she whispers to herself lines of this prophecy or this belief, you know, that he will know your ways despite, you know, not being raised in them. And so it's hard not to, you know, when all these little things, you're having these dreams that you're not sure come true or not, and then you're seemingly fitting into the culture so well. I mean, how do you not believe your own hype, you know?
Yeah, which is usually what leads to maybe a little bit of a power-hungry person. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yes. So, you know, after the, you know, big attack, everyone's just murdered left and right. But Paul and his mother are able to, you know, get away. And then you kind of get introduced to the Fremen. I want to talk a little bit about Zendaya because pretty much up to the end of the film, you're only seeing her in these dreamlike states that he has. And so the implication in these dreams is not only that he'll know her, but that they're, you know, romantically together, that they fight or work together. It kind of varies in the ways that she's, you know, romantically with him, or she's like kind of, you know, I'm with you as like a follower. And so he's constantly seeing these visions of her with these blue eyes that the Fremen all have from the spice, you know, breathing in the spice all their lives. And then you see her at the end, like you finally, it's funny rewatching it when we did last week, I go, wow, she's so little in this film. And she's like right behind him in the poster, but like so little do you actually see her talk.
Marketing 101 there. Zendaya is in your movie. Make sure people know about it.
Absolutely. And I just think, you know, it's, and you missed, like you get enough of her where you're like, oh my God, when is he going to meet Zendaya? You know, and they give you just enough where it's not like all of a sudden she's batting her eyes at him. She's just kind of like, we'll see if you make it. You know, like I don't believe your hype. She kind of is going into. So
yeah, she actually, she gives him her Chris knife, which is like one of these sacred knives that I believe it's made from teeth of sandworms, right? So she goes, here you go. This has a great meaning. It'll be an honor to die using this, essentially. And he goes out there, never had a battle with one of these guys, and just is toying with them. One of the funniest scenes, it goes, do you yield? Starts screaming it. And everybody's like, dude, we don't. You kill them. You don't yield. What are you talking about here? And that's like the first time he kills them. And everybody's like, oh, shit. All right. This guy can do some damage. And you also see his mom's got a little bit of fighting chops there, too. But That is when Zendaya's like, all right, you know what? Follow me. I'll show you around. I'll look out for you. And as we've seen for the trailers for Dune 2, it turns into a little bit more than a budding friendship, Kayla.
Oh, who could have guessed, you know, when you have two very attractive young actors that they would get together. I want to talk about that scene you just mentioned, too, because, again, shout out to Rebecca Ferguson. She's so good when he's like, eh, kill her. She's old. And she just completely, like, gets him, fights him, and then has a knife. And he's like, oh, shit, didn't know you were a fighter. My bad. My bad. We're cool. We're cool. And, you know, it's a great scene, that fight he has with one of the Fremen guys that are just, like, so, like, you're fuck you, basically. I want to kill you. He has a vision before then where that same guy is teaching him, is taking him under a wing, is like in this, you know, dream, is like, hey, I will teach you my ways. And so it's like our first kind of actuality of like seeing it where he had a dream like that you think may happen and didn't end up happening. It completely went a different way. So it begins to wonder, like, are his prophecies or these dreams prophecies or visions of the future, does he control in some way? In what way did he alter that man from taking him under his wing to killing him, then dying? So he never ends up, they never came to fruition. So I don't know. I have a lot of questions on that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, does Stilgar take the place of what that guy would have been, the guy played by Javier Bardem? Or does him killing him change trajectories? Or is he seeing visions of, you know, I can't, multiverse is all over the place, so I'm not saying this is a multiverse, but is he seeing visions of different outcomes based on different types of actions? So maybe he sees the vision of him teaming up with this guy, and maybe in another sequence it's, all right, if you kill him that leads to X, Y, and Z. If you would have just left them and let him survive, you still would have found your way back. We don't really know the details on that yet, which is what keeps things pretty interesting. And just to throw on the Rebecca Ferguson point here, another one of my favorite scenes, when they are in the copter basically being dropped off to die, and they have her gagged, but not him. And you can see that she is very powerful, because the whole thing is like, make sure she doesn't get that gag off, because then she's going to just murder us all very easily. And he's able to do it. And then, or he, I believe he's able to summon the voice very quickly. And then he gets the gag off of his mother, and she just immediately goes, kill him. Unhand me, kill him. And then it's like, shit, she said seven words and just disposed of these guys that quickly. Like, this is a powerful person.
It's a perfect, like, kind of catch up to a scene earlier when she introduces Paul to the leader of the Bene Gesserit, and he's like, at the end, he's like, oh, I'm in danger because I'm the son of a duke. And she's like, no, you idiot. It's because, you know, you're the son of your mother, yeah, who's a, like, badass. Like, no, like, well, forget about that. And I just love that, because he's so immediately goes to like, oh, because of my dad. He's like, no, because your mom. And so I do love how, you know, they treat gender in this film too, which is so like the power within both. And, you know, even within the frame, and is like, can you kill? Cool. You're like one of us, you know?
Did you have any other major scenes that jumped out to you in Dune 1?
You know, shout out to Jason Momoa, who's just, you know, I'm really feeling for some of these like big actors. By big, I mean muscular, and finding their path into like kind of these roles. I think Jason Momoa's in a bit of a slide here. Hopefully he can recover. But I've been praising Dave Bautista. I go on so many The Rock rants. I don't need to now. But Dave Bautista, just, I'm telling you, he's doing the things he needs to do. He understands that, like, his body puts him in certain roles. But he's played from the, you know, M. Night Shyamalan intense, you know, horror sci-fi to, you know, like the comedies, like the little girl football player. I don't know if that was one of his movies, or, you know, like, he just plays so many different roles, from big picture to, you know, Marvel, Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, he's rocking it. I just want to shout out to Dave Bautista, because I'm loving what he's doing. He's taking it so seriously, and he's so good, right?
Yeah, he is like a perfect casting for this kind of like lieutenant of the Harkonnen. Right. I don't know if is it his uncle or his father, whoever is the head baron, who is played by Stellan Skarsgård. But he's basically the lieutenant that's running through these things and like performing things on the ground. And he just has that natural physical, well, not naturally, puts a lot of work into it, obviously, but his imposing physicality immediately makes him more terrifying than if you have somebody that's 5'10", 200 pounds. You know, he's just imposing. And when you add the fact that all these people look like Voldemort, like you said, that adds a little extra layer of fear behind it, because it's like, shit, these guys don't see the sun. They just care about murder and money. So who knows what they're capable of?
Yes, he's like a mix of Voldemort meets Jabba the Hutt. Like, his just body is just so grotesquely slimy. I mean, literally when he's just on the precipice of death from Oscar Isaac's, like, poisonous
You're talking about breath. The Baron now, right? Stellan Skarsgård.
The Baron, yeah, sorry, yep. And, you know, he gets remade or healed in this, like, oil-like black substance. It's just, that is, like, such the, like, Star Wars-y, like, you know, what is the substance he's being healed in, you know?
Yeah, that was very similar to Mandalorian last season vibe.
Oh, yeah, completely. I just, you know, it kind of ends on Paul, you know, coming to this agreement after killing, you know, this member of the Fremen. He's like, okay, you're one of us. We'll teach you, you know, the ways. And Zendaya's character is kind of like, okay, we'll see how this plays out. And, you know, Rebecca Ferguson, his mom, is like, you know, Jessica's like, we should really be trying to get to another home, you know? And Paul kind of takes it like, no, like, this is where I'm meant to be. I'm supposed to be here. You know, these dreams have led me here. And so that's kind of where it ends, and it just leaves so many possibilities to what's going to happen in a week when we see this film, you know?
Which leads us right into our Dune 2 preview, Kayla.
You know, tentative preview. Obviously, we haven't seen this film. It's going to follow our guy Paul as he unites with the Fremen people of the desert planet Arrakis to wage war against House Harkonnen. Stars the same cast. Obviously, we lost poor Oscar Isaac. Introduced Austin Butler, which looks crazy in kind of his role in this.
He's what playing gonna be. The assassin Fade Rotha, yes. I guess is how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And he looks like a psycho. And I think one of the trailers say that guy's a psychopath. So
he looks it.
Looks like it.
I'd be curious if he has the Elvis voice. Can't wait to find out. Of course, I mean, Florence Pugh is going to be in this movie.
I thought you would have just overlooked her. Yeah.
That escalates the film completely for me. And I understand her not to have like a humongous role in this movie, but absolutely, obviously delighted anytime I see her on screen. Christopher Walken's going to be in this film, and Anya Taylor-Joy is also going to be in this film. She has another movie coming out, Futurosa. So just exciting time for her as well. Our Queen's Gambit, if you will.
Love her. I don't know how big of a role she has in this, because she wasn't on like the lead cast list, but everything she does, she's very good in. So I'm intrigued.
So, you know, knowing that we have a kind of a base of where this movie's going to go, what are you most looking forward to in the sequel? Obviously, it's Florence Pugh for me.
Well, obviously, it's Florence Pugh for you. Yeah. So we did see a little bit of a sneak peek, and this is shown somewhat in the trailers, but when we watched the re-release in theaters, we had a sneak peek of the sandworm scene. So you have this awesome scene where Paul is trying to figure out how to ride a sandworm, and this to me is an indication of they're going to start utilizing these creatures as warriors in this war to come. They're going to use them as like a part of their army, and this is the first step to making that happens. So I'm very intrigued to see how that all plays out. And based on the trailers here, we see a couple things that I noted down. And obviously we can't really spoil besides what we saw in the trailers, because we don't know what happens. I haven't read the books, but Austin Butler, like we said, looks like a psychopath. And a lot of his scenes look like they're in black and white scenes to kind of give a different feel to it, I guess. But he is face-to-face with Paul at one point. It looks like they're battling each other. Paul is face-to-face with the Emperor at one point that they're talking. So you know that he at least has a conversation with the Emperor, unless it's some type of dream sequence. And he starts to develop this this charismatic messianic leader figure where people are like, oh, is he taking over? Is he doing too much? And you're starting to see a little bit in the trailers of, is he taking this too far? Is he out for revenge too much. And then you get the quote that I noted down as soon as I saw it from Rebecca Ferguson's character, your father didn't believe in revenge. So that right there in a trailer means he is clearly out for revenge and he's probably going to go overboard to get it, which is going to be what sets him off kilter because that's not how his father would have wanted it. So there's like a lot of pieces moving here, which is why I was glad to see that at least Denis claims there's going to be a third movie. Who knows when that'll actually be confirmed. But with all these open things, I'm like, how are we going to finish this in like a 2.5-3 hour movie? I need more time in Dune.
Yes, we certainly do. And please don't like make us think we're going to see a movie in November and then push it back out to March. I do want to say that was also torturous for us for the hype meter for last year. You know, besides obviously seeing Florence Pugh on the screen, I'm excited for her character and what I think she's very much enmeshed in Paul and Channing's character. And so I'm curious how that looks like, since it seems like they're so in the desert of Arrakis. I don't know how like other people kind of get mixed in because they're kind of on the run a bit. So I'm curious like how that's going to play out.
She plays a princess, like a royal, a part of the royal family, right?
Yes. Yeah. That I think helps them out in some way, Paul out in some way. And so I'm curious what that looks like. And two, I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, Paul get with Zendaya, you know, Paul and Shani getting together. Like I'm curious because she's so like, whatever.
You want a now, desert sand sex scene is what you're saying between
I do. I absolutely do. Chalamet. You know, and I want to give another, you know, praise to Timothée Chalamet because his physicality, he's very slim. He's lanky. He's super skinny. So for him to play this kind of imposing force really is, you know, a credit to his acting ability because he is not very like imposing in stature. You know, and comparatively to the other people that are playing in this film. So I think it really says a lot that you're looking at him like, oh, he's going to like beat the shit out of this guy. When you're like, oh, I think if like you were in a, you know, a parking lot, you know, Timothée Chalamet, you're not going to bet on him. Maybe
that's one of the things that makes it most interesting to me because he doesn't have that same physical, you know, presence to intimidate people, but he has such control over his body. So he takes people by surprise. Like that first fight we saw with the Fremen, he assumes he's going to be able to murder this kid easily, but he has trained. We see him training with one of the heads of the House Atreides army earlier on in the first movie. So again, he's putting in this work to better himself, to put himself in these situations to succeed. And one of his dream situations at the end of the first movie was seeing himself in the middle of this battle, like leading the Fremen. And he gets kind of like woken up like, oh man, like what's happening? I don't know if I can deal with that. So it'll be intrigued to see how this somebody who is starting to understand the power he has, how that eventually starts to corrupt him and vengeance becomes his number one priority. Cause that is what we're getting from the trailer a little bit. And I'm going to throw a prediction out there, Kayla, if you're okay with this right now. We have the mom is pregnant. Don't forget. We were told the mom is pregnant because he had a vision and she's like, nobody knows that. How the hell do you know that? And my prediction is the end of this movie, I'm assuming there will be a third movie without it being fully confirmed, is he comes to power. He leads the Fremen. Like, he gets the sandworms on inside. They overtake House Harkonnen. He defeats the Emperor. He becomes the new Emperor and becomes the person that he was kind of fighting against. And then we're going to see his mother has the child, which is going to be a daughter. Prediction. No idea. I could be way off base here. And the daughter in the third movie is going to be the person that's got to take down Paul in order to write the universe. Thoughts?
Do you find that similar to any storyline in sci-fi? Perhaps the infamous Star Wars, that's perhaps?
Very similar.
Where it's not Anakin, it is Luke, is what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
But it's Leia. You're saying Leia is the one that defeats Vader. I think that's so Star Wars. Granted, Dune came first, and I'm sure Star Wars took some things from Dune. That I would be not impressed if that's the way it goes, just because it is basically Star Wars in that way.
The other, because we know the mom's pregnant, so that there has to be a significance to that in my mind. The other option is,
see, I think something happens. She to loses the, mom, the baby, and I think, and then, like, correct, shit goes yeah. crazy.
Yeah, that's the other yes. route it could go. Yeah,
I think that it, as a way to change the trajectory of Paul, perhaps, because he does rely on his mother and is trying to push away from her at the same okay. time. So.
Uh-huh. I like that.
And I don't know her place.
So he's like, I lost my father. My mother lost, either he loses the mother or my mother sure. lost her child. And then that's right. what turns him. Gotcha.
Some sort of, like, I mean, somebody could say an Anakin. So I guess maybe it all will play out in the Star Wars way. Granted, a sibling and not necessarily a father son, but, you know, that'll be interesting. I mean, I'm sure Star Wars got, you know, its intel from Dune a bit. So that'll be interesting how that goes. I'm curious about, you know, Jessica's role in this, because, you know, they, you know, Javier's like, his character is with Paul because Paul killed someone and that's their way to be like, you're one of us. But she didn't necessarily have that. So I don't know, like, where she lands, you know, in powers and ability, like where she kind of has her place in that culture. So I'll be curious, like, how that looks.
Did you see her in the sneak peek that we saw of him?
No, we
getting
didn't.
On the sandworm.
Did
I did not see her in the background shot. So
no,
maybe she kind of goes off on her own.
Correct, because she kind of has her own, you know. And I don't know if the Fremen know about the voice, this other kind of ability he has. He didn't perform it with them yet. So is that something that they're like, whoa, scared of, or they don't know, so he's able to kind of use that? I don't know where that comes into play too. I'm interested in.
Well, clearly there's got to be the little love situation here with Zendaya, where they are all about each other, and then he does something that rubs her the wrong way, and she thinks that he can't be redeemed. Like, that happens in pretty much every movie where there's two people that have found each other. So we'll see what turns him that way.
I'm just literally now totally in the world of Star Wars, so I'm also picturing a Padme. Like, I'm just picturing, like, she believes that he's the chosen one, and then it goes sour, you know? And then he's like, you know, if you're not with me, then you're my enemy. You know?
And then he goes and murders children? I don't think it's going that far.
I guess we'll find out. We don't know. Now, I don't know if you know, but there is talk of a spinoff to the Dune world, which is a book, Messiah. And I believe this has way more of Florence Pugh's character in this. Are you interested in kind of spinoffs of the, like, do you want to linger in the world of Dune?
As of right now, I am going to say yes. I am hesitant with how the last 15, 20 years of the Marvel and stuff, where it's just spinoff, and it dilutes the brand a little bit. So I'm a little bit nervous, but as of right now, I'm all in. I also saw that there's supposed to be a TV show coming out on Max, Dune, The Sisterhood. But I don't know if that's been canceled, because I haven't seen anything new in like 6 months on that. And it was like, oh, it's supposed to come in 2024. Ooh. And then I was like, did they just cancel that?
See, my hair starts to raise when you say TV show, because that's where I start to feel, you know what I mean? If Denis, like, directing Messiah ends up his own spinoff, I'm like, got it. He knows the world. So far, he's not done this wrong. I don't think he will anytime soon. But, like, a TV show, I assume he's not going to television. So it would be, like, other voices. Yeah. I'd be a nervous. Little like, oh, no, you're going to butcher it in TV format, even with HBO behind it, you know?
So is Messiah supposed to be the third installment or a completely separate story? Because I was trying to find information before we got on the pod, and I saw something that said the third part could be based on the 1969 book Dune Messiah. But there was no confirmation on that. So I don't know if that involves Paul or if that's...
So it is, I believe it's like events that happen over a course of time. I just don't know if it's like at the same time as this story or it's like the future. I believe it's like a further exploration of characters we're going to be introduced to. So I don't know if it's post. I'm also trying not to look too much into it because I have no clue what Florence Pugh's character is like gonna, how she's gonna be involved in it. But I heard, actually reposted on Twitter, something where it said like, hey, be with me in this movie. Florence Pugh's often being told that, like Christopher Nolan's like, hey, I got like a 2-minute scene for you, but like, will you join me in this movie? I think Denis's like, hey, you're not like super massive, presumably in this role, but if we do Messiah, like this is your movie. Like you're kind of the star of it. So again, I don't know if it's her history before part two or it's like the future. Like maybe she's involved later. I don't know. But obviously I will be there. So no doubt.
100%. You're not going to not get us to see any type of spinoff. I mean, we'll see it. We just hope that it's good.
Yeah, we've seen it up. We've seen all the X-Men movies, so we will be there, okay? All right, I think that wraps it up for us on the Dune Part 1 talk. Obviously, when we see Dune Part 2, we will come back on the pod to talk about it. I can't wait to talk about it with you, Justin, and with our audience, and hopefully everyone goes out to see it. Let's go ahead and get to our Swirly of the Week.
All right, I'll kick us off on Swirly of the Week this week, Kayla, because there was a bit of a big sports event that happened recently. I don't know if you're aware. The Super Bowl. So the Super Bowl had the San Francisco 49ers versus the Kansas City Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes. My Swirly of the Week is Kyle Shanahan and the San Francisco 49ers. He's their head coach. This game went into overtime. Only the second time in Super Bowl history it's gone into overtime. And there were new rules that were developed a couple years ago because the Bills lost to the Chiefs and they didn't get a chance to have the ball in overtime. So I think everybody that's a big football fan knows that the rules changed. So the new rules are both teams get the ball no matter what. So if you score, the other team also gets it. They get a chance to score. And then if you both do, whoever scores next wins, essentially. The San Francisco 49ers won the coin toss for overtime and decided to go first, giving Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs the ball second, which is just a mind-boggling move here. You give them the opportunity to know exactly what they need to get, a field goal or a touchdown. You give them one extra down. They can go fourth down here to keep moving the ball. That's a huge advantage when you're trying to win a game in the Super Bowl. And then when they were asked about it, the players after the game, and we even saw people mic'd up during the game, they were like, oh, we didn't know the rules. Like our coach didn't, like, we didn't go over our plans for overtime. They had 2 weeks to prepare, plus the whole season. They didn't know the rules, the players. They talked to the Chiefs players. They're like, oh, we've been practicing this all year. We knew exactly what the rules were. If we won the toss, we are going to select to get it second. And we were just pumped when they wanted the ball first because we would have gone for 2 points and tried to win the game no matter what if they got a touchdown. And it's just such a really baffling head coaching decision at the biggest moment of his life to trust that your defense is going to stop one of the greatest quarterbacks we've ever seen when he has an extra down and knows exactly what he needs to do to win the game. I can't fathom it. Massive Swirly move, buckled under the pressure. And then when they showed the mic'd up things that came out after, the Chiefs were running to the sideline after the 49ers said they wanted the ball first. And you see Patrick Mahomes going, they want it. They want the ball. Like, we're getting the ball second. And they're like, they're all ecstatic. And they're like, this is what we wanted. Let them have the ball. We're taking the ball second. And we're winning this game. It don't matter. And I just, as it was happening, I was like, what is this guy doing? Even though I was rooting for the Chiefs in that moment. So huge Swirly move, Kayla. And you look like you zoned out about 3 seconds into that.
I did watch the Super Bowl. And despite myself, I was obviously there for my favorite part of the Super Bowl, which is generally the halftime show. And then I dip out. But it was an interesting second half than the first. So I was like, okay, I'm kind of invested to see how this goes. I was definitely rooting for the Chiefs, too. Coming from a sport which I watch over, you know, football, basketball is MMA. And so funny enough, with our rules in different states, there are different rules, like disqualification. So like, it's crazy that there's somewhat of a universal rule set, but you could go to California and you could put a leg and 2 hands down, and you can't get hit. But you can go to a different state and you can get hit. You can get a knee if you have 3 points of contact. Like, so a lot of times fighters sometimes come into situations where they do something and they don't realize that they can't do it. And you're kind of looking at the coaches like they, you know, the refs come in before the fight to reiterate the rules and make sure they understand. But, you know, you're the heat of the moment. You see someone down, you, you know, you go to fight. And so I similarly, I guess I kind of know what that's like, where they're just like so confused at what happened here, but you're right. They had time, and that should have been relayed to them. So the 49er fans were pretty solemn. I always enjoy the post though, when people are like talking shit about them. You know,
you just love to tear people down, Kayla. Yeah.
I have no investment in the sports of football. So I find it funny how seriously people take it, you know? Love it. All right. My swirl of the week is going to be, I won't say a huge spoiler for you because you haven't watched any of the 6 episodes, but I just got to shout out something from Love is Blind because there's a new season. Hopefully we'll talk about it soon. But 6 episodes actually dropped, which I feel like is a lot more than normal. But last season sucked, so I kind of went into the season like, let's see. But I think we've proven this experiment doesn't work and that Love is not blind. Sorry, but it's not. Unless it is, you know. And so, you know, you're introduced to these people. Now, I can't wait to hear your thoughts on some of these couples and the doomed levels they are. But anywho, I'm going to send you a photo now. And one of the contestants, her name's Chelsea, and she was in the pod. Now, once you get this photo, you tell me what celebrity lookalike you may say she looks like. And if one doesn't come to mind right away, I will tell you what she told him in the pod. Again, the premise of the show is I do not know what you look like. I'm going to propose to you without knowing.
Yeah.
But she told him someone that she's often compared to. And I believe that changed the complete trajectory of how he selected her.
That's like going against the rules. You're not supposed to be like, oh, well, I can't tell you what I look like, but I look exactly like.
There was a lot. There was some of that this season. So is anyone jumping to mind?
I am looking at her. No celebrities are jumping to mind. She's got a very long face, like a very pointy chin.
So let me tell you what she said. And she tried to say it very casually, like, oh, you know, my friends, you know, people always tell me I look like Megan Fox. So.
In what world?
No matter what.
What world?
No matter. And
that guy 100% said yes after that. I don't need to see any of the episodes.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
He was like, oh, Megan Fox? Listen. You know what he should have responded with? Is that just because of your thumbs? Because she's got really weird thumbs. We've talked about this before, guys.
Yes. But yes, yeah, we have.
No, she, I so see zero.
It's
comparison.
So funny when he, like, she tells him that and she says it so kind of like casually laughing. And you see his face change where he's like, I'm all in. Now, screw granted, all the other girls. Also buffed the whole premise of like, I don't know what you look like, but absolutely. He had that in his mind when he was selecting her. And when it comes to the reveal, was my favorite part. I love watching their faces to see how fake they are. If they're like, oh my God, you're beautiful. Or they're like, hey, and his face was a broken man. Oh, and it's so funny because she's not a bad looking woman whatsoever, but it's because he had Megan Fox in his brain. And at one point, you know, they embrace for the first time, they kiss, they usually propose, and they sit on a bench and just talk about their initial feelings really quick. You can see that she's so overjoyed with him, and he's just so like, oh, yeah, I'm so excited. And then they show, like, a confessional, and he's like, yeah, I guess she lied about her looks because she does not look like Megan.
He straight up said that? Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. He's like, yeah. And so you could see him replaying his choices and wishing he made it differently.
Well, you know, honestly, so funny. That's what he deserves because the whole point of the show is Love is Blind, not Love is Who Looks Like Megan Fox. Like, this is
100%. Insane. She shouldn't have said that whatsoever. And so,
and you can't set the bar that high, honey. I'm sorry. No. I mean, maybe she just really wanted somebody to like say yes to leave the place together, which, okay, brilliant move because that's going to work 99 out of 100 times. Like, oh, I look like Margot Robbie and Megan Fox, like, together. Like, just, that's just ridiculous. You can't set the bar that high, though, because no matter what, the guy's going to be disappointed.
Just other insane. People have to tell you that. Yeah. When you start saying it about yourself, that's where people start to go, I don't think so. So it's there's more to that as they go along and you see that he's stewing and is like, fuck. Granted, the other one he was between cursed him and said he will need an EpiPen because he's going to choke when he sees the other woman that he selected instead
of
her.
Is she a member of the Bene Gesserit?
I think she is. Okay. She used the voice, and that's also why he regrets it. You got to watch this season, Justin. It's wild, but that's my story of the week. It's like you doomed your experiment. You know, like you set a picture, whether true or not, and now like I think you're gonna suffer the consequences. Unfortunately,
yeah. Well, they both deserve that then because they both did not take the experiment the right way. I mean, people are trying to get on reality TV. We saw that last season a little bit where there was some. For sure. You know, fudging around to get on the show with people that you were stalking beforehand who are super creepos anyway. But maybe I'll start binging that and we can do a little reality TV pod about the challenge, Kayla, which the last episode is going to be coming up here. Are you caught up so we can talk about it, Kayla?
How about I catch up on the challenge and you catch up on Love is Blind? How about that?
Because I had a big win last week in the challenge that we can talk about next week.
Okay, got it. Agreed. Ka-choo. All right. All right, let's go ahead and get to our friendship question of the week, which is, Justin, what is one of your favorite childhood books?
So as we've talked a little bit about on this pod, you're the reader. I'm not as much of a reader. Mm-hmm. So maybe for school I'd read. Sometimes I'd listen to audiobooks and try to absorb the information as I slept. Thinking ahead here. That's four-dimensional thinking.
You listen to audiobooks as a kid?
One time for school as I slept so that I would absorb the information and be able to write essays on it. I did pretty well on the essay. Anyway, so as a kid, book that jumps to mind is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which came out in 97. And that was – the reason that sticks out is because I vividly remember reading that with my mom. Like we'd sit up like on the chair on the couch and she'd read like a chapter, I'd read, you know, and we kind of go back and forth and read the books together. And I believe we got through the first two books. And then once it was to my own fruition, I did not read any more of the rest of them. So so basically, Ma, if I'm going to read any more of these Harry Potter books, I just need you to come over. We could just rotate who reads a chapter and call it a day.
Yeah, I love it. I love it for you. That's great. Yeah, you know, I got into Harry Potter late, so I probably came in at like the third book in high school, I think it was. So interesting. So what comes to mind, it's funny that you say audiobooks, because when I was a kid, I used to listen to like cassettes like they used to in the library, our local library in our neighborhood we both lived in. They used to have like these bags that would hang on a rack and it would be like the cassette and then the book.
Gen Zers we're talking about the year 1947. They got no clue.
Even though cassettes are back in, I will say crazy, but of all the types of things to listen to, you guys, cassettes are not it. Anyways, two books come to mind, and one is The BFG, which was a book I probably got from the library like every week. Like I think
is that the majority big fucking of people giant?
Read that book was me. No, oh, no, okay. Big Friendly Giant, Big Friendly Giant.
Same difference. Okay.
You know, I reread that like 1,000 times. I'm telling you, it's so funny. And they did have a movie, a Disney movie that came out, but I didn't want it to ruin kind of what I loved about it. So I didn't see it, but I love that book. And then I also really loved Sideways Stories from Wayside School. And I think that book kind of warped my like horror love as a young kid, because it was a story where it was about a school and each chapter was like a different student. Although sometimes different students came together and it was told differently. I mean, one story was told end to beginning. Another story was like an evil witch of a teacher. Like one is like, we don't go to the 13th floor. And then what happens on the 13th floor of the school? Like it had kind of like for a middle schooler, like a kind of twisted, horror-like stories in each chapter. Some of them were super freaky and scary. So I definitely think that like got me interested in horror as a genre as a kid. I was definitely reading like grown-up horror books as a kid. Definitely Goosebumps, like loved all that stuff. I love the teen versions of Goosebumps, Fright.
So it was, like, Fear Ball, Street. I had a lot of Goosebumps books.
Yeah.
And I don't know how often I really read them. I used to love the ones where there was like I was like, this is such a great innovation where it's like, oh, there's multiple different storylines. If you want to do this, go to page 47. If you want to follow this, go to page 96. And I'd be like, this is so cool.
the choose your own adventure books, I also love, but as someone who chronically like always wants to make the right choice and is afraid of failure, I stress myself so much. I would like save the choice page.
Oh, no.
So if it didn't work out and I died or something happened, I'd be like, go back, go back, go back. maybe that's where my anxiety came from. Who knows? But yeah, I highly love that. I used to read the Fear Street books too in middle school, which were the teen Goosebumps, where like basically couples murder each other. Like it was like the psycho killer in your friend group. But I was like 12 reading that. So, yep.
That explains so much.
That's how
so
I became
much,
who
Kayla.
I am.
Explains so
it
much.
It does, doesn't it? All right. I think that wraps it up for our episode today. Again, please see Dune, whether you see it in theaters, whether you see it on Netflix, watch it, and then join us when we watch Dune 2 and talk about it, because we absolutely can't wait.
Seven more Dune. Sleeps, Kayla. Seven more sleeps.
Yes, let's go. See you next week.
Well, that's it for this episode of Wrong Opinions Only. Please follow us on Instagram at Wrong Opinions Only and on Twitter at Wrong Opinions JK, where we'll be dropping some clues and hints to upcoming episodes. Until then, JK out.